The next case is in the interest of Brianna B. and Riley B. And we have an appellant and two appellees in this case. It is our intention to allow all of you full 10 minutes to argue your case. And so we have, first of all, the appellant, that's Ms. Merwin, is that correct? You may proceed, Ms. Merwin.
Good morning, members of the panel. Counsel, may it please the court. I'm Diane Merwin, attorney for appellant father Brian B. As you know today, we are here because my client's parental rights were terminated in the trial court under subparagraph 7 of 43-292. It is our position that there were two critical errors in this decision. First, the trial court erred by finding Brian to be unfit, and second, that the termination was in the best interest of the children and I was. The case began with a removal on January 14, 2015, due to drug use and possession of parents. The parents then entered no contest plea. At this position, a case plan was entered. They worked that case plan, and the children were placed back into the home of the parents from November 2015 through January of 2016. This is the time frame that the trial court relied on to determine that Brian was unfit and that it was in the best interest of the children to terminate his parental rights. The termination trial occurred in March and April of 2017, and the order was then entered on May 30th of 2017. Essentially, during that time frame from November to January 2015 to 2016, Brian was being asked to do something that was nearly impossible. He was being asked to dance on the blade of a double-edged sword, essentially. During that time, Brian and Shauna were having marital problems. There were arguments, fighting a lot. That had been an issue in their relationship. Brian had reached out to his supports for assistance, those supports being Health and Human Services and the foster parents, who had asserted themselves as a support to Brian, and who the department had recommended he utilize as a support. The evidence was clear that Brian was the primary breadwinner for the family. He worked long hours in order to do that. So while the children had been placed back in their home with their parents, he did what a lot of parents do, and he relied on the parent who was at home to take care of the children while he was at work.
What was the evidence of providence then during that period of time with Ron being the primary caretaker?
Brian reported concerns. There were evidence of problems. The concerns that the department expressed was that the children were supposed to be in daycare, they were supposed to be in preschool, they were not making it on time, or they were being picked up late. And those were times that the evidence showed that Brian was at work, Shauna was supposed to be responsible for those things. Additionally,
what steps did he take once he saw that she wasn't doing those things?
Well, initially, of course,
what did he do?
Initially, of course, it was trying to talk to Shauna about that. Then he did report to the department that those things were not happening and that he was concerned. He did also, the evidence, and I believe in both exceptions, the evidence did show that he started doing more transportation in the morning, things like that. But ultimately, you know, he was kind of at a loss of, what do? I have to work. And that's kind of what brings me to that double-edged sword situation. Additionally, there were concerns then after that. The concerns were that Shauna wasn't taking care of him, she was sleeping. He would come home, they hadn't been fed, there was issues. And so he reported those as well. Essentially, he was then using his supports. He was using the foster home. He was using, talking to the department, using the resources that he had. But again, you know, we were back in the situation where he had a difficult decision to make. If he hadn't reported those things, he would have been essentially neglecting the children. He reported them. He was asking for help, using his supports, reaching out, which is exactly what the the case plan study he was supposed to be learning how to do was exactly what we expect to have happen in all of these juvenile cases.
So the kids went back to foster care in January of 2016.
That's correct.
And then when was he incarcerated?
He was incarcerated in March of 2000. Yeah, March of 2016 is when he was sentenced. And he was incarcerated at that time.
Until I think roughly August of that same year.
Actually, he ended up back at the work release center in Lincoln and was able to reinitiate visitations, but that was around July. He didn't actually parole completely out until January of 2017.
So let's talk about after the kids were removed in January 2016, what steps did your client do to comply with the plan?
Okay. So my client, at the time that the children were removed again, he continued to have unsupervised visits and included even weekends and extended visits. He continued to work with service providers, held his job, continued to do drug testing. And that's a big piece here. He, you know, the case started in 2015 with drugs, and he never failed a test, and he completed ever the entire time.
They did find him with a bunch of beer.
They did find him with beer on one occasion, and that is correct. But he did not fail for any illegal substances. He also completed intensive outpatient. He completed outpatient twice. The second time was not due to any relapse, it was not due to any concerns, it was because it was part of his parole term when he got out.
It seems that there was concern about the children and their relationship with, I guess, both parents. Do you think that's what swayed the juvenile court in this case?
I believe that the court did put a lot of weight, I guess, on the testimony of the therapist. I believe that was me. The resumption of contact, the trial court held in order that resumption of contact with the parent after Sean's jail and Brian's parole created negative behaviors for the children, and that was based on his testimony. However, the family support worker who did the visitations said that there was absolutely no safety concerns, no problems, that the children were happy, that they had a really huge connection, in her words, with Brian, and they continued to comply with all of the service rules throughout that time. On February 14, 2017, the team, which consisted of foster parents, the parent, the family support worker, had a meeting. A decision was made to add an extra visit for Brian with Riley, because Riley was asking for more time with his dad. And so that was just about a month before the termination trial. As far as the therapist's testimony, though, I think it is important to notice that, you know, the therapist never spoke to the parents. They never gathered any information from anyone who had anything to do with observing the parents and the children together. They had never been at any of the visitations. Ms. Benchoff actually had only had contact with the children on a day of her evaluation. Additionally, they were never able to, 10 days prior to the termination trial, we had a hearing about visitation, and Dr. Benchoff testified they didn't know what it triggered was for the children. So the only thing that happened, though, from that 10 days to the termination hearing was that she found out she was going to testify at the termination hearing, and that the foster mother, who had also testified that she wanted to adopt the children, had gone to them with information, new information to them. However, it was information about hoarding food that allegedly happened back in January of 2015, so it wasn't new information. And that information was all of a sudden made the therapist able to say, oh, the trigger is contact with parents. But even when they said the trigger is contact with parents, they weren't able to say with certainty. They were only able to draw likelihoods of whether or not it was Brian specifically, Sean specifically, or both parents. So that testimony, I think, lacked a lot of credibility as far as and how much weight it laid. I think was way overdone.
Can I talk to you? I want to talk to you about the timeline. Given the timeline in terms of the incarceration. It's my understanding it was shortly after the incarceration that the termination motion was filed. that correct?
He was incarcerated in March of 2016. The termination motion filed in July.
Which is about the time that he
was getting into
the work release center. Okay. 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 So we have, at least in your view, a period of progress.
Progress.
We also have the divorce going on.
And
I guess my question to you is this, is that he had all these difficulties when, I mean, I'm assuming he had similar progress that led up to the original reunification with the parents. I mean, they didn't place the children back there because if there was no progress being made. So tell me what is different now. I mean, these parents seem to be capable, and we'll give you a couple, I'll give you a chance to answer, but they seem to be
capable
of having good visits. What tells me now that he's going to be capable of parenting these children? What's the evidence that tells me that?
A lot of, if you look back through the evidence, former case plans, court reports, even prior to the original return of the children to all of the reports were good about Brian and his parents. The delay, the reason it took even 10 months, I think, for the kids to get back home was because of delays and the pushback they were getting from Sean. What's changed, the main thing that has changed, is Brian is done trying to fix Shauna's parenting, and they're divorced, he's moved on. He still has his home, he still has his job. So everything
his job is self-employed.
Correct.
It's the same job that he had that he didn't have time to take him to work, to daycare the first time around.
Correct. But it's not that he didn't have time. I think he was, it was that he was trying. The kids had been returned to both parents. He was trying to have the mother be the parent that he thought she could be and wanted her to be. So what's different now is that now it's done. That he knows it's not going to happen, at least not with another the same book. And so he's moved on and he's able to do. There's nothing in the record showing that he's not able. It's just that when he was relying on someone else, it wasn't happening. And then when he asked for help.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Kolesch? Hey, please court. Counsel. My name is Keith Kolesch. I represent Shauna B., who is listed as the appellant on this case. I think right off the bat, I'll just address the issue as far as her status as an appellee versus what should have been a cross appeal in this case. When this was filed, it was filed as a brief of the appellee. Obviously, it should have been labeled as a cross appeal. I do believe, though, under Knob versus Knob, when you look at the brief, is laid out in the way that's ordered by the court in the form for a cross appeal, even though it has it was not labeled as a cross appeal. I think under Knob where the court indicates that even though a brief violates the rule regarding the presentation of cross appeal, the form and presentation of the assignments of error when they confirm the with the rules applicable to an appellant's brief, it can be considered effective as a cross appeal.
I don't know the year that Knob was.
That was 1994.
And after that, then, don't we have a Supreme Court case of interest of Natasha H., where a father appealed the termination of his parental rights, but he failed to properly designate his arguments in a cross appeal? The Supreme Court said, sorry.
Well, that was also referenced in a 2013 case in Recoy P. In that case, the court did say even if it was improperly filed, if the arguments are basically the same as what the appellant's arguments are, then the court can still consider the argument of the appellee, even though it was not filed as a cross appeal. Okay. Basically, with Shaughnessy, we're in the same situation as what the appellant was in, as far as what we're looking at, whether or not she was an unfit parent, whether or not the kids are going to be harmed, or if it's in their best interest to have their parental rights terminated. I think when we're looking at Shauna's case, it's a little bit different. She had a lot more difficulties than what her husband did, what Brian did, leading up to her incarceration in May of 2016. She did have issues as far as following some of the orders of the court, as far as completing her treatment, including drug testing, and that kind of thing. But she did, at the point where she was incarcerated in May of 2017, again, the termination was filed in July of 2016. It was May 17th of 2016. Termination was filed July 13th, 2016. She was released from corrections in Lincoln. Again, she was in the Lancaster County Corrections. She wasn't in the Department of Corrections, where in Lancaster County, they didn't have the facilities or the means to allow her any kind of visits while she was incarcerated. That was one of the issues where she was able to have attempts at phone contact, but that was basically being controlled by the foster parents, so there was pretty limited contact there with the children. But upon her release on August 22nd, 2016 from Lincoln or Lancaster County Corrections, she did immediately go to the Department of Health and Human Services, got her visits started again, basically got the plan of what she needed to do to have contact with the kids again. They initially wanted her to do therapeutic visits with the children just because there had been that time that she hadn't been seeing them. She completed the therapeutic visits. It was progressed to supervised visits, where she had 12 hours a week. She did live in Gretna. The kids were living in Auburn, so she had basically weekend visits where they extended periods of time, 6 hours or so per visit. So she wasn't having an extended period of time where she was able to parent the children. And I think with the testimony of the visitation worker in this case, it's either that when she was having visits at her home in Gretna, that they weren't having any problems. They weren't having issues with the way she was parenting the children. When the children would give her a hard time, she would appropriately parent the children. If there was, I think there was one instance where one of the children had a rug burn, she took care of it like she was supposed to. There was never any issues as far as her visits and her parenting.
What about her compliance with what the requirements? Especially with the drug
She did drug test, and once she was released from the Lancaster County Corrections, she didn't have any, she never failed the drug test. She complied with all the drug testing requirements at that point. And we're looking at a time frame between her being released in August of 2016 to the time of the termination hearing in March of 2017. We have a time frame of about 7 months where she's been clean, hasn't had any issues with the testing. And again, we're looking at when we get to the termination hearing, we're in a position where she's basically doing everything that's asked of her. She's doing the visits like she's supposed to. The visits are safe. She's having contact with everybody that they're asking her to have contact with. The problem that we ran into is, which was indicated again by the appellate, was when we got to the termination hearing, we're having these reports and testimony from the therapist, from the psychologist, and those reports and the testimony was made with no interaction and no contact basically with the parents, either Shauna or Brian. So again, we're in a situation where they're making these determinations on the children of how the parenting and how these parents affect these kids without ever actually talking to the parents or even talking to them, much less actually observing them in contact with the children. The only person that actually testified at the termination hearing that actually observed any contact with between Ms. Betts and the children was the visitation worker, and she testified there was absolutely no problem. She never saw any issues with them.
Did the visitation workers give any opinion as to whether what they thought about moving towards a reunification plan?
I don't recall right off the top of my head specifically if she said that. I know that the visitation workers can be pretty reluctant to make that kind of statement in court, but I don't remember right off the top of my head.
Is there any testimony from any either social worker or expert that thought that reunification was an appropriate plan?
I think at that point where the court was had already made a ruling on permanency, where the permanency objective was adoption, nobody even addressed that. Everybody was moving forward for the adoption. Again, a lot of the information that was given to the therapist and the psychologist.
No, couldn't you or put on that testimony? I mean, if you think that that is supported, I mean, couldn't there have been, was that question even asked?
I believe that the testimony of the visitation worker was sufficient to show that they should have been moving to that point where they should have.
Isn't there a difference between they can successfully do visitation and they can successfully parent? We have at least one example where they didn't successfully parent after being successful at visitation. What tells us now, or what told Judge Moshman at the time, that they're going to succeed this second time around?
I think just the behavior that was put into evidence as far as Shauna, from the time she was released from Lincoln Corrections to the time of the termination hearing, she made significant progress. I mean, the progress that she made in that 7 months was by far and away much more than she had made previously. I think when you're looking at these cases, yes, you do look back to see how things went, but you also need to look forward and see how things are going. One of the problems she ran into is that since they filed the termination, they would not allow, the department wouldn't allow, under their rules, they wouldn't allow anything more than supervised visits. They wouldn't allow any more than a 12-hour visit. I think it says a lot in Brian's case where, you know, you actually have one of the kids requesting more time and they shuffle times around to try and get him more time. Again, Shauna was in a different situation where she is in Gretna. Basically, she sat with the weekend because they didn't want to transport the kids an hour and a half every time for her visit. So she was pretty much stuck with the amount of time that she had. But again, because of the department's policies, once the termination was filed, she is stuck with supervised visits and was never going to move off there unless we could get the court to do that, which we tried to do 10 days before we had the termination hearing. We had the hearing to try and increase the visit, and that's where we got into the testimony from the psychologist and the therapist, who again were only gathering information from the foster parents from the department. They never got any information to make their recommendations through any kind of contact with the parents. So I think that does show a lot that basically we got to a point where they weren't going to, the court, the department, nobody was going to allow anything additional on this. They were going forward with determination, and that's what they were going to do.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you. Mayor Roach. Mr. LaGore.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Angelo Rigori. I represent the state of Nebraska in this matter. Every time I hear words "let justice be done here," it gives me butterflies in my stomach. I honestly think it makes me a better lawyer. I appreciate it every time I hear it. I'm a parent. I'm concerned about parental rights. It's on the foremost of my thought a lot of time. But I don't put parental rights in front of the care and welfare of children. This case, one of those cases where the care and welfare of the children stood out overwhelmingly. We had a 27-month proceeding. We had review after review after review. Progress just did not get made.
What progress was it?
Throughout the process, when we look at it, we say, could the parents address any health concerns? No, they did not address any health concerns.
health concerns, not addressed.
Well, there was a contact about ear infections that the kids were having. Those were all handled by foster parents. At one point in time, the father, towards the end, actually had Riley and was out playing with him in 30-degree weather. Riley has severe ear infections. Brian made no concerns about it, was told about it, no concerns about it. The health concerns, the issues of the actions that the kids were having, the outbursts that the kids were having, the sleep deprivation, the concerns with what were they eating, hoarding food, the concerns in school, any educational concerns. When they went back in December with the parents, they were tracked extremely.
That was that November of 15.
December of 2015, correct.
So let's talk about the evidence. Really, say after the father in particular was released from when he was on work release and then starting to interact with the kids again. And what did he not do after that to comply with the plan?
I think our Judge Hopsburn said it the best when he said there's a difference between visitation and parenting. What he did do to comply with the plan is the kids were taken to him, and he stayed with them. And part of that was he was on parole, and part of that was...
He has a residence that's suitable. He's employed. He's paying his bills.
I would say
done all of the drug treatment required. No positive tests. The visitation worker said, the visitation's going very well. So seems like the state turned the corner pretty quickly then, after the release from incarceration.
In regards to how the house is in foreclosure, we don't know how long it is going to stay out of foreclosure. His employment was self-employment. It never once was ever confirmed. Never once. The interesting thing about Brian was he was unemployment at the time he did the meth deal that got the kids taken away from him. He was working his employment on that day in his truck with his trailer going to pick up supplies at Menard when he did the meth deal up in Lincoln and purchased meth and was going back to purchase more meth. That's Brian's employment. In regards to supervision, care of the children, he never paid support the entire time. Indicated to the court that he didn't have any funds to ever pay support. Within appellant's brief, the argument was that he was in tough financial circumstances, yet there was also the argument that he worked long hours, sometimes till 11 o'clock at night. Brian, at the time of the trial, indicated that he made $100,000 last year. He said, what did you do? Did you indicate to that to us when you asked for court-appointed counsel? No. When we looked at his request for court-appointed counsel, he indicates he didn't make anything. We've never seen any indicator that he's ever made anything. All we see is indication of him dodging everything. What was convenient for Brian was self-employment, saying, hey, you know what? If you're looking for me in Auburn, I'll be in Lincoln. If you're looking for me in Lincoln, I'll be in Auburn. And that's what he did. So when parole looked for him in Lincoln and said, hey, we need you to come in and do a drug test, I'm in Auburn. Or I'm someplace else. I'm self-employed. When the Department of Health and Human Services tried to locate him and do a drug test in Auburn, I'm in Lincoln. I'm someplace else. I'm self-employed. As he indicates, hey, I never missed a drug test or I never tested negative. That's because a lot of times he never tested. At the end of the proceedings, towards the end of the proceedings, when he came out on parole, he told the Department of Health and Human Services, there's no need to test me. Parole's testing, and it's completely random, so you never know when it's going to happen. So the department didn't test him. The department listened to him, took his view into consideration. It probably should not have happened because when they contacted parole, parole said, yeah, we can do it, but we haven't been. We've never tested him. He hasn't been tested in 2.5 months. So they weren't testing. He wasn't getting tested at all, and he knew it.
Did he present any evidence that verified that he was working? I mean, are there receipts from client, or, you know, from work that he did, or tax returns, or anything of that nature?
I think at the time of trial, he presented one receipt from a contract that sends, I believe, but never showed any other indication that he had been working, never paid any support for the children for 27 months that the children were out of home.
Was there a request for support in the record?
I believe there was a request for support towards the beginning, and
no. The hearing held on?
I can't remember off the top of my head, honestly. I don't remember. At the time he went to prison, in these proceedings, that was the second prison term at this point in time. The determination was that he'd go to prison because he wasn't a viable candidate for parole because of his likelihood to be involved in criminal activity if he was backed out.
What was the prior incarceration for?
Can't remember.
Was that in the record somewhere?
He talked a little bit about it in his testimony. I asked him specifically if he had been incarcerated prior. I think it was drug-related charges prior to. But yeah, it was a second incarceration to prison. He didn't want to speak to any criminal activity. He had ongoing criminal activity. We had criminal activity at the time that we were going through the proceedings. He had an attempted taking advantage of a minor child, of a child that was currently involved with him at the time of the proceeding, and was on again, off again, staying at his house with her mother. So all these events.
And that was in the record.
That is in the record. Yeah. There was never any indication by Brian that he wanted to take care of his children. Like I said, when you look at it and say, did he address any health concerns? No. Did he address educational concerns? No. At the time of trial, he was at a question mark of where the youngest child attended daycare. Did not speak or contact teachers. Did not coordinate with any teachers. Did not go to any school events. When the children were returned to the home, he was arguing, Shauna can't take care of them. Yet at the very same time, he left the children, went to a job that nobody knows where at, was gone for 3 days, said when he came home that Brianna was playing in her own feces, and that Shauna didn't even know he had left, and that the kids were there to take care of themselves. And that didn't seem to bother him. The only indication that he was bothered by was these kids need to go back into foster care. These kids need to go back. Somebody else needs to take care of them because we're not going to do it. And that's I think, a large part of the concern here is, yeah, you know, he can show up for a visitation late in the proceedings. The department can bring the kids to him. Some of my concern even with that was we had a very young visitation worker at that point, fresh out of college. She was, at the time of trial, she was already done doing that. She went home for personal reasons. She had lost her father when she was young. I think that Brian played on those emotions with her. I think that's why we have some of that evidence that we had in the record with her in the first place.
Thank you very much. This case will be taken under advisement. We will issue a decision as soon as we can. All right. Parties are excused.